Welcome, dear listeners, to a chilling and festive edition of Dead Evil Tales. As the snow blankets the world in a serene hush, and the twinkling lights adorn every corner, we invite you to gather round the digital fireplace for a Christmas episode unlike any other. This holiday season, we delve into the haunting tradition of telling ghost stories at Christmas, a practice that has stood the test of time and adds a spine-tingling layer to the merriment of the season. We are available to haunt you on Apple iTunes, Spotify, and all other streaming services. But remember, be sure to subscribe to the podcast or your souls will be damned. Every like, subscribe, and comment helps the ghouls to keep creating these horrifying tales for your sick and twisted minds. This episode is brought to you by Dead Evil Clothing, where they sell fashion fit for the afterlife. Get 10% off your otherworldly attire when you use the code DEADEVILTALES at checkout. Visit www.deadevilclothing.com to claim yours. This episode's eerie tale is from the chilling mind of author Lex Jones, taken from his book of Christmas ghost stories, The Season of the Spirit. So, dim the lights, stoke the imaginary flames of anticipation, and prepare for a spectral journey through the snowy landscapes of the supernatural. This Dead Evil Tales Christmas special is not for the faint of heart, but for those who dare to embrace the spectral side of the holiday season. 'Tis the season to be haunted, after all.
Wednesday, 29th of November. I arrived at my new church to find it was about half the size of my last one, which, I must add, brought me to a state of joy rather than disappointment. I spent the past 4 years working out of a city parish, which of course necessitated a much larger church. Not that the size of the congregation these days had filled it to even half capacity. But still, a building of that scale can seem intimidating, and often did. After the financial scandal, in which the seniors of the church disagreed with my using of the church funds to help a struggling family, I was forced to move to a more out-of-the-way locale to keep things brushed under the prayer rug. So, here I am. Amberton is a rural village that's just on the cusp of becoming a town, I'd say. I don't know the exact statistics for such a transition, but the mines have brought much boom and business here, so I've learned. There exists on the edge of the town a large row of houses that are much newer build than the more traditional stone ones in the area, which includes my own clergy house. I dare say they have better heating, plumbing, and clearer signals for the television as well. Still, I am very happy to be in an area such as this, particularly with Christmas on the approach. The coming of the festive season really does make my job easier with regard to ingratiating myself into village life. Faith is dying out here, as it is in all places, really. So to suddenly arrive in the midst of summer with the goal of reigniting it might seem a little lofty and ambitious. To do so in the Christmas period, however, when even the staunchest disbeliever feels a touch of the spirit in the air, is somewhat an easier task. For one thing, the church is likely to be more full than it would usually, which also allows me the opportunity to meet greater numbers of the locals, without doing something so intrusive as to go knock on each of their doors. Saturday, 2nd of December. It's been a strange few days. That's left me little time to write here. My head's been buried in a diary, but rather curiously, not my own. I should elaborate. I suppose it started when I was at the local shop buying a newspaper. An elderly woman introduced herself as Gladys and asked whether or not I'd be lighting the Advent this weekend. Now, I will admit, I shouldn't have been as surprised by this request as I was. Traditions like that had somewhat faded in my previous parish. But, as a broad stroke, it's probably fair to say that they hold on stronger in rural communities. I admitted to Gladys that I hadn't even given any thought, but that if it was a village tradition to do so, then of course I would make an event of it. She then said the most curious thing, which was that it was important I light the Advent whether or not it were made a social church event. She also insisted that I kept the Advent lit at all times. One candle for each weekend on the approach to Christmas, as is traditional. But still, once the first was lit, it must remain so constantly. And then once two were lit, they must remain so, and so on. I asked her why, and she replied simply that it was an important tradition begun by Father Hurst, my predecessor. I didn't know what to make of this, but gave her my assurance that I would light the Advent crown beginning this coming Sunday, and leave it lit. Of course, in reality, keeping it lit all hours in a drafty village church is somewhat unrealistic of a promise. However, I will make sure it's lit during the hours when anyone is likely to visit, at the least. That should keep Gladys, and any other parishioners, happy that I'm doing my best to maintain village traditions. Once I arrived back home, I sat down to read the newspaper I'd just purchased. The front pages were full of whatever antics that Liverpudlian music group were up to, so I skipped ahead a few pages. It's not that I have no interest at all at whatever movements form part of the current zeitgeist. It's just I don't feel such things really qualify as news, and they're currently not why I purchased the newspaper. Still, it seems my attention was not to be fixed for long on current events, regardless of their level of importance. As I read about the upcoming vote to abolish the death penalty in this country, about time, I must say, I found the house grew noticeably colder. Perhaps it was the subject matter and the voiced opinions of the article that all criminals should be hung without hesitation that brought a chill to the air. I can't rightly say, but I did all of a sudden notice that I could now see my breath before my face. The heating of my house was a rather old-fashioned setup, so my immediate thought was that this was probably to blame. The boiler was to be found in the corner of the loft, which was accessible by a hatch, with a fold-out ladder behind it. Sure enough, having made my way into the dusty old loft and come face to face with the boiler, I saw the pilot light had blown out. As I reignited it, I heard a heavy thud behind me. I turned with something of a start. Nothing else resides in the house besides me. I have no cat, although I do intend to get one, so to hear a noise that was beyond the creaking of a floorboard or the banging of a pipe was far from expected. As I turned, I saw that a wooden chest had fallen from a shelf in the corner of the loft, and now lay face down on the floor. The shelf, which the chest had resided, showed no sign of being loose, and I can only assume that the chest had not been properly balanced. And my sudden presence in the attic had somehow been the catalyst of its sudden disturbance. As for the chest itself, it was around the size of a large hat box, I would say. My curiosity was piqued, as anyone's would be, so my thoughts immediately turned to opening it. How grateful was I, then, to see the latch keeping the chest closed was bereft of a lock. Flicking it up was enough to allow the chest to be opened, which, naturally, I did immediately. Inside the chest was an old church advent crown made of iron, and a thick leather-bound journal. I say journal, perhaps a bit hastily, as I didn't immediately recognize it as such, and only confirmed upon opening it. At first glance, I took the journal as a Bible, given its thickness and the weight of it. Indeed, there were some passages from the good book pasted into it. Photocopied pages, I might add, before you worry that someone had torn out said pages. But the majority of the book were writings of its author. The author was none other than Father Michael Hurst, my predecessor at this parish, and the previous occupant of my new home. The journal contained much of his own thoughts, as his diary contained my own, but also a section that was devoted to something of an instruction manual. Instructions specifically relating to the Advent crown that had been placed in the same box. The instructions detailed how the crown needed to be lit from the first weekend in December, with the second candle being lit from the second weekend, and so on. Fairly standard procedure for a church tradition, I thought. But the instructions then went on to echo what the lady in the village had said to me earlier. From the first weekend of Advent until Christmas Day itself, the crown must be kept lit at all times. To accomplish this, the candles were in fact hollow, with their faux wicks drawing up from a well of liquid paraffin that filled the middle of the crown. If it were filled daily, this fuel would mean the candles kept burning for almost the entire month of December. So, despite my previous misgivings, it seemed that keeping the crown constantly lit would not be such a hassle after all. What I still failed to understand was why it was necessary. Traditions are fine, and certainly have their place, and I'm hardly the person to deride such things given the nature of my chosen life. But something in the way Father Hurst wrote about it still sits ill at ease with me. I can't quite describe it. His instructions aren't simply a matter of this is how to use the special Advent crown, but rather an insistence that what he described must be done. Perhaps the rest of this journal provides more details about why he felt this way, but I've not yet had the time to pursue it. I put the journal and the Advent crown back in the chest, and decided I would bring them downstairs with me. I wasn't yet decided whether or not I'd actually honour the tradition in full, but I'd certainly set the crown in the church. As I closed the chest and lifted it, I caught sight of a shape in the corner of my eye. There, in the far shadows of the loft, a figure stood watching me. I froze. Nobody could have climbed the ladder in the time I'd been up there. They simply couldn't. Which left the possibility that this person had already been residing in the loft when I ascended the ladder myself. The notion of a third possibility, which falls more firmly under the realms of the absurd, did occur to me. I shan't say that it didn't. I did not truly wish to turn and see whoever might be stood behind me, but I knew that I had little option. So, gathering more courage than logic would suggest is necessary for such a basic act, I turned and demanded the figure told me what they wanted. Sure enough, there was nobody there. Now, your thoughts about this are probably that of the shape that I mistook for a figure was nothing more than shadows formed by the slanted roof. coat hung on the wall. A hat stand, perhaps. None of these were the case. There was truly nothing on that side of the loft that could have formed a shape of my vision. As I stared into the shadows, I became aware of somebody stood very close to my left side. I felt their breath upon my face, and my eyes fixed themselves shut. Whatever this was, I had no wish to see it. A voice whispered in my ear, "Light it."
Light it.
And then the voice and the source of it were gone. If, in fact, they had ever been there. Taking the chest, I left the loft far more hastily than I climbed up into it. Once in the daylight-filled rooms of the house below, the experience I'd just suffered through seems the stuff of folly and imagined nonsense. Too much dust, too much shadow, too many nerves set on edge by Father Hurst's feverish writings. It's easy to mock oneself when looking back on these moments, but at the time of their happening, they seem terrifyingly real. I am not altogether ashamed to admit it, that I left the hallway light on as I retired to my bed for the night.
Light it.
Sunday, 3rd of December. I lit the first of the candles adorning the Advent crown this morning. There were about a dozen or so people in the church for the ceremony, most of whom had been present for the Sunday service beforehand, but others came late. It'd be easy to take umbrage to that, but I shan't. The village needs to get to know me, and if the way to attract people to the church for now is through rituals and excitements of the festive period, then I think I'm perfectly happy with that. I got to meet some new faces and say my hellos, so I think all went rather well. The lighting of the candle itself went without incident as well. I hadn't had the time to practice beforehand, so the act of filling the crown with paraffin oil and not spilling it all over the floor had to be conducted for the first time in front of an audience. Thankfully, my hands didn't shake, and the stand on which the crown was placed was nice and sturdy enough that it didn't sway. I said the prayers and led the hymns as given in Father Hurst's instructions, the congregation joining in, as you'd expect. The final prayer, however, was said by me alone, owing to the fact it was in fact in Latin. I will confess here that I didn't fully understand it myself, but it was something about the light holding back the darkness that was here before. If truth be told, I rather suspect Father Hurst wrote that one himself, which put upon me the desire to go back and read more of his journals. After saying goodbye to the congregation, and agreeing to enough invites for tea and Christmas cake to see me through the winter, I was left alone in the church. The candle still burned, and the glass slit on the side of the crown allowed me to see the paraffin levels, as though I were checking the fuel level of some crucial machine. I estimated that I'd need to refill it every couple of days, but of course this would increase in frequency with the subsequent lighting of more candles. I can't say that I'm overly concerned about the possibility of the candles going out for a short period, but my experience in the loft yesterday, even though it was assumed to be a product of my imagination, makes me feel as though I ought to be. As I was left alone with these thoughts in the church, I felt a sudden draft blow against my face. Actually, no, that's not the correct way to describe it. The draft felt more like that of a pull than a push, now that I think on it. As though a sudden rush of cold air was being drawn from behind me, like a large inhalation. I turned, and immediately facing me there was nothing but the church altar. The altar itself was made of heavy solid oak, and covered to the floor by a red tarp with gold trim. Atop this stood a golden cross and two slim white candles, a stark contrast to the red ones which adorned the Advent crown. My eyes brought me to the sight of nothing unusual around the altar itself, but there was a sound of howling wind coming from it, like a crack in the wall of a windswept castle. I approached it, and whilst I could no longer feel the pulling draft, the sound got louder as I got closer. I reached out and touched the altar, my hand shaking involuntarily as I did so. The instant my hand made contact with the altar, the wind-like sound was replaced by a sound that I can barely bring myself to describe. The screeching roar of metallic nails are tearing down a blackboard. The roar of a lion blade backwards. A thousand bows tearing badly against a thousand violin strings. So loud and so horrific was the sound that I dropped to my knees and covered my ears. I felt as though my eardrums might burst. The pressure on them so intense that my eyes watered and winced. My hands still clasped against my ears. I looked up and saw a shadow rise along the rear wall of the church, covering the statue image of our Lord on the cross. Covering his mother stood to one side in mourning, covering the angel that watched over both. The shadow was huge, larger than anything inside the church that could possibly have been the source of it. And its shape. Dear God. Its shape. If I were to ask you to imagine the shadow of a million writhing snakes, or perhaps tentacles, that might bring something to your mind which is close to what I saw. I closed my eyes and joined the hideous noise with a scream of my own. And then all fell silent. Tentatively, I removed my hands from my ears and got back to my feet. My entire body was shaking, and I looked all about me for any sign of what I had just seen with all the caution of a nervous cat. I saw nothing. I heard nothing. No shadow, no unholy sound, nothing at all. Except, however, the fact that the first candle on the Advent crown had now gone out. I relit it immediately, and then quickly locked up the church and went home. Tuesday, 5th of December. I lost most of Sunday afternoon, and the entirety of Monday to my studies of Father Hirst's journal. I have lost much of today as well, were it not for a phone call reminding me of tea and cakes with Mrs. Wedgeworth's house. Slightly flavourless as the cake may have been, it was a welcome distraction from the pages of that old journal. Father Hirst's journal. What can I say about it, and still sound like a rational man? Well, it's clear he was passionate about this village and its church. Let me give him that due. Like myself, it seems as though he was not in fact a long-time resident of the village. He'd come here in his 30s, as I have myself, and stayed here until his death about 4 decades later. He truly had loved the place. In this time here, Father Hurst had studied much of local history, and for want of a better term, folklore. Whilst the official doctrine of the church is to disregard such things and replace old beliefs and superstitions with the practice of good, moral Christian worship, it's certainly true that it had been known to be flexible in such things. There are many priests in Ireland who would confess to a belief in fairies and still keep an iron frame around the doors of their houses, for instance, and many more who still partake in seances and the like. As for the village of Umberton, Father Hurst had discovered it had not always been quite so pleasant a place as it is now. The Black Death, the somewhat colourful name for the bubonic plague, had struck the village hard. Many of its families were lost, never to be replaced. The remaining ones abandoned their faith in God and turned instead to something else for protection. The exact name or nature of what it might have been, Father Hurst does not detail. In fact, he seems to devoutly refuse to do so, as if properly identifying it might give it power. Nor does he say how well, if at all, this new form of faith performed in protecting the village from the plague. It's certainly true that enough survived to see the village through to a new era of prosperity in the years that followed. But how far this can be laid at the door of superstitious practices is probably open for debate. The plague subsided in many areas of England, which never claimed to have turned to any Faustian bargain after all. Father Hurst had detailed how the church sought to re-establish itself in areas where its hold had loosened, and Umberton was one of them. The return of, as he describes it, the light of Christianity to the area appeared to have been welcomed by most. The practices of this new faith they'd adopted had apparently not settled easily with the village, whatever benefits it may have seemingly brought to them, if indeed it had brought any at all. So the new church was built, and as Hurst writes, the old darkness was locked away beneath it, sealed forever by the light of faith in God. The true God, to use his words, although personally I'm not sure a term is necessary unless we accept that other beings might exist who claim divinity. His writings over the year are mostly what you'd expect from a priest's journal, so I won't detail much more than the minutia lest my own journey become merely a copy of Hurst's. It is only in his later years that he once again refers to the history of the village, and that's when the crown is first mentioned. The long and short of it is that he believed a shadow was spreading within the church. That statement sent a chill down my own spine. Given my own experience at the altar, the decline in the church attendance had, to Hurst's mind, reduced the power of the place as a barrier against what came before, and in a period of the darkest month, December, the power of this, whatever he believed it to be, was at its peak. So he added further strength to the ritual of the Advent crown by keeping its light burning through the entire month. This, he believed, would suffice in making up the shortfall caused by the empty pews. I have no reason to believe that Father Hurst was a man possessed of anything other than sound mind, right until the end. His writings always remain clear and concise at all times of the year, except when he talks about the crown and its purpose. At the time of these writings, every year, it is as though a desperate fury comes over him, and he can think of naught else. I pity him, really, to have become so obsessed with a ritual of his own devising. And yet, I can say that, as I sit here, in daylight, in the comfort of the modern world, with no consequence. But all I need to do is think back to my own experience in the church last Sunday, and the very real chill travels down my spine. Sunday 10th, December. I led the church service today, against the doctor's orders, despite having missed Mass on Friday. Father Lewis, lovely chap from the neighbouring village, retired now, but still in good health, came over in his car and led the Mass for me. But today, I had to light the crown. I couldn't bear not to. I should elaborate. As I have mentioned, my health without explanation. Around Thursday morning, I started to feel very weak, as though the strength had been stolen from my limbs. Next came a fever, then cold sweats, and finally an absolute inability to keep food or liquid in my body. Now, to contract the flu at this time of year hardly seems unusual, I acknowledge, save for the fact that I have not been in contact with anybody else who seemed to be suffering from it. Rather, it seemed as though the illness had manifested in me alone. The strength of my symptoms grew worse as the day went on, until I could barely rise from my bed by the evening. It was as I lay in a feverish and sweat-covered state that I once again became consumed with that feeling that I was not alone in my house. The door to my bedroom was open, allowing me easy access to the bathroom along the hallway. In said doorway, I could see a shadow of a figure. No, not a shadow, for shadows are pressed against walls, floors, and ceiling. Rather, this was a shadow as though detached from a surface. Clearly, not a fully solidified image, but present nonetheless. This was not at all like the shadow I'd seen in the church, but instead, vaguely humanoid. In my almost delirious state, I would have sworn that somebody stood in that doorway. It seems simple to try and pass this off as a fever dream, but the similar experience I had whilst in the loft was born under no such illness. I stared at the shadow, finding it unnerving and yet somehow not terrifying in the way that the monstrous shade in the church had been. The right arm of the shape raised and pointed at me, then moved to the right as though pointing beyond the walls of my house. And then I heard a voice that came out, not directly from the shadow, but from all around me.
It has gone out!
The icy chill that caused me to shudder violently cut through the fever and forced me from my bed. The shadow was gone as quickly as it had arrived, but fever dream or not, I couldn't ignore its words. I felt compelled by them, as much in soul as mind and body. Climbing from my bed, ignoring even the prospect of a quick bath to freshen me up, I dressed and dosed myself up with as much cold medicine as I could safely take, and then walked to the church. Putting one foot in front of the other was more effort than I can describe to you. More than just illness, felt as though something were actively trying to push me back with each footfall, and I am aware of the ludicrous nature of this statement, but I can only document my own experience. At least some modicum of luck was on my side, however, in that I didn't encounter any parishioners on the short walk to the church. It wasn't simply that I didn't have the energy to talk with them, but also that I dare not be slowed in my purpose. Arriving at the church, I locked the door behind me so that nobody might wander in and distract me. My eyes then turned immediately to the Advent crown. It was unlit. I had somehow known that this was what I would find, and yet this prediction did nothing to quell the horror of the sight. Resting on the pews as I went, my strength abandoning me already, I staggered over to the crown. Opening the hollow section, I discovered that the paraffin, well, was bone dry. Of course it was. I was due to refill it today, and my sickness had prevented me from coming to the church to do so. Was the subconscious reminder of this what gave form to the shadow in my doorway? That seems a logical conclusion, and yet it doesn't fit with what my mind is increasingly believing to be the case. Father Hurst wants me to keep that crown lit, and is informing me of this in whatever capacity that he remains able, wherever he may be. Thankfully, I had previously had the foresight to leave a bottle of liquid paraffin in the utility cupboard, so I took this now and refilled the crown. My hands shook as I did this, causing some of it to splash on my sleeve. I ignored this and lit the first candle. Somehow, the flame had flickered to the side and caught my sleeve, setting it alight. I furiously patted it out, burning my hand in the process. More and more, I felt as though I was beset by competing forces of unnatural origin. Father Hurst, who wanted me to light the crown, and something else which wished to prevent this very act. Once back home, I called the doctor to come and see my burned hand, and whilst there, he also gave me some better flu medicine and ordered me to rest. I conceded and arranged for the Friday Mass to be taken care of, as I have previously explained. I felt well enough today that I took the Sunday service myself, which, of course, included the lighting of the second candle on the Advent crown. However ridiculous it may sound, I will now ensure that they stay lit until Christmas Day, to be joined by a third and fourth candle, as the ritual demands. Sunday, 17th of December. I recovered from my illness around Wednesday of this week, and haven't really had the time to write in this journal since then, as I was expecting to catch up on church matters. I held Mass on Friday, which was busier than I expected, but not as busy as I'd hoped. And today was the Sunday service, followed by the lighting of the third candle of Advent. The final candle will be lit on Christmas Eve. The lighting of the third candle went without incident. I don't exactly know what I was expecting to happen, but given the unusual events that had occurred since my owning of the ritual, I have suffered from a vague anxiety around it. This is concentrated largely around ensuring that the crown remains lit, which I have now done on a daily basis. But the anxiety rose to a crescendo when it came time to light the third candle. Even there, in the midst of a not exactly full, but still healthy church congregation, I felt that creeping dread. As I reached for the wick, something was going to happen to prevent me from lighting it. Another illness. An accident. Even the guided hand of one of the parishioners. Guided by what? I cannot say. Thankfully, I was wrong in every regard. As I stated, the lighting of the third candle went without incident. You'd think this would fill me with relief, perhaps even a reassurance that the previous events were indeed the product of an ill mind and body, coupled with a fired-up imagination. I feel no such cause for celebration. Rather, I now suffer from a creeping dread at the back of my mind, as though I am not out of the proverbial storm, but rather sat in the eye of it. As though my opponent is merely biding his time for one last push. Sunday, 24th of December. I'm sat in the church as I write this. I've pulled a folding chair next to the spot where the Advent crown hangs, and I sit with the paraffin bottle and box of matches ready to relight as often as is required. It keeps going out. There's a noise inside the church. Terrible. A natural noise. And a howl that rises to a crescendo. One which has nothing to do with the snowy winds blowing in through the shattered windows. I feel my mind may snap, and so I must write to stay focused. The snow started on Friday evening, just after Mass, and has not stopped since. It has actually fallen heavier and heavier as Sunday approached, whilst the arrival of a heavy snowfall just before Christmas Day is welcomed by many. I did not see it this way. I feel that at any other year, I would have joined the chorus of those sledding and building snowmen and enjoying the magic of the season. But I did not see thusly. I saw the snowfall as yet another barrier. The intention was for the snow to fall so heavy that I couldn't even walk to the church for Sunday service. To barricade the door with such strong drifts that the church would be sealed. I know how this sounds. You must believe that I know, but I am sure of it. Whether there was indeed malicious intent behind the snow or not, it did not prevent me from getting to the church this morning. Few made the journey, but I cannot really blame them for this. With it being Christmas Eve and the downfall being so sudden, there has been no efforts to clear the roads or walkways in the village, so conditions have become rather treacherous. There were less than 10 of us in the church, but that was enough. As long as I was there to light the final candle of the Advent crown, that was all that mattered. I believed, naively, as I now understand it, that the lighting of the final candle would put an end to it. How foolish of me. No sooner had the congregation left, the joy and light of their faith and celebration now departed from the church, that a draught blew through the church so fiercely that two of the candles went out. I relit them immediately, and in doing so was beset with an agonizing cramp along my arm. I dropped the box of matches and clutched at my shoulder, so blinding was the pain. I felt, though, the limbs of an octopus were wrapped about it, clenching tighter with each second. Was this a heart attack? It was my left arm where the pain was, which is, I am led to believe, where the pain occurs during such an ailment. I didn't know what else to do, so I staggered to the altar and knelt before the cross, then prayed. This act of prayer did indeed relieve the tension in my arm, as though whatever had grasped it had been forced to let go. But the rational part of my mind insists it is merely that I had calmed myself down. But at this point, I didn't know what to believe, for in the next moment, the entire church shook, as though struck with a mighty blow of force. Not from above, however, but from below. The Advent crown swung wildly, and two of the candles went out. I got to my feet and ran to it, steadying my hand and then re-lighting it. I checked the paraffin levels and I was assured it was still more than half full of fuel. I had become somewhat obsessive about not letting the fuel drop below a quarter, but nonetheless, I couldn't help but check each time my eye met the slit where the fuel level could be seen. The church shook again. This time the altar being forced forwards down the steps with such a crash that I felt I may suffer a genuine heart attack this time. The golden cross skidded across the floor to my feet, and I instinctively picked it up and clutched it close to me. With my free hand, I steadied the stand atop which sat the Advent crown. A sound of howling wind now filled the church, as it had done with the lighting of the first candle, and once again I could detect its source. It was coming from where the altar had once stood. There was something below it, hidden in the floor. I wanted to move closer, but I daren't leave my post. The crown couldn't be left unattended, for I feared this would be the end of me. The church shook again, and this time two of the windows broke inwards, the shards of coloured glass flying into the church. I was far enough away that I wasn't injured by the jagged projectiles, but I still watched in horror as those beautiful images were destroyed forever in a moment's violence. Snow blew into the church, bringing with it cold storm winds from outside to accompany the unnatural wind from within. I shielded the Advent crown with my body and began to say the Lord's Prayer over and over. After the seventh time through the prayer, the unnatural howling ceased, and even the snow blowing in from the outside seemed to lessen. I took this moment to furiously write this entry in my diary, lest my sanity abandon me, and I remember these events in the future as not having truly occurred. I must document them. I cannot allow whatever this presence is to fool me into thinking I have merely lost my grip on reality. Its attack has ceased for the moment, but this is, once again, the eye of the storm. It wants the light of the crown to be blown out, and it wants to return to this world. I cannot let it. I know if I keep the flames lit until the midnight hour, when the holy day is upon us, then all will be well. I must keep the crown lit. I must.
From the police records of Constable Peter Scales, December 26th. I was able to get access to the church on Christmas Day morning at approximately 12:05 a.m, after clearing heavy snowdrifts on the door. The reason for my visit was that I was inquiring after the safety of Father Leopold Dunley, priest of Umberton's church. He hadn't been seen since the morning service on Christmas Eve, and phone calls to both his home and the church had gone unanswered. When the few devout souls who had braved the weather for the traditional midnight mass arrived at the church, they found the doors barricaded from the inside and several of the windows broken. At that point, the police were called. I was able to climb into the church through the use of a stepladder and one of the broken windows, as I was unable to force the doors against whatever weight was set against them. Once I got inside, I saw that several heavy wooden pews had been uprooted and pushed against the door, which was the source of the barricade. The altar was upturned and fallen at the top of the church aisle, just at the base of the steps, and broken coloured glass littered the floor from the windows. Snowdrifts had formed inside the walls where the snow had blown in. Where the altar had once stood, a hidden trapdoor, covered in engraved scripture, was now open and left ajar, revealing beneath it a stone chamber that was 6 foot wide by 6 foot long by 6 foot deep. Nothing was found within the chamber, except for the black slimy residue of some oil-like substance. A trail of the same substance could be seen stretching from the edge of the trapdoor, down the steps, to the centre of the aisle. The blackish trail stopped at the exact point where I found Father Dunley. The priest was unconscious and his body extremely cold. I was able to rouse him and immediately took my jacket and wrapped it around his shoulders. Then I quickly went back to my car and radioed for an ambulance. When I returned to the inside of the church, he was on his feet. I told him to sit on one of the pews and he complied. I asked him what had happened and what was the origin of black oil-like substance that had left a trail from the secret trapdoor to where I'd found him. He explained the chamber had been a store of some very old and very valuable wine and liquor from centuries past, when smugglers would hide their wares by bribing the church. Apparently, some local reprobates broke into the church to steal the wine and found the priest already in attendance. He attacked him, barricaded the church door, and escaped via the broken windows, spilling some of the liquor in the process. I will state for the record, I do not believe this to be the full truth. The black liquid does not look like liquor to me, but has more in common with the trails left by a slug, a snail. If it isn't liquor though, I have no idea where else it might be. Father Dunley's explanation of the attack also doesn't add up. He says they struck him in the back of the head, yet he has no visible wound or any evidence of concussion. What he does have are several burns on his arms and neck, as though ropes were wrapped around his person. I also found traces of the same black liquid around these burns. I believe Father Dunley is protecting somebody, a theory that was reinforced when he stated empathetically that he didn't wish to pursue the matter or seek to press charges. His reasoning for this was that the young men were clearly desperate, and at Christmas we must remember the Lord's message of forgiveness. My final comments on this matter are regarding the character of Father Dunley himself. I've only met him on one or two occasions before this incident, but I feel as though the attack affected him more than he claimed. I fully suspect he was in shock, and not yet himself, despite his insistence otherwise. As I removed the barricade and took him from the church, he seemed very out of sorts. His voice, his mannerisms, even the way he smiled, none of it seemed that he was quite right. This feeling was further cemented in my mind when, as we left, I pointed the broken Advent crown that lay on the stone floor. It has become well known in the village how seriously Father Dunley has taken the old tradition of Father Hurst's Advent, so his reaction to the broken crown was surprising to me. I asked him if he'd be getting it repaired in time for next year's Christmas period. His response was he would not, and that the crown no longer served any purpose.
this bone-chilling episode of Dead Evil Tales. We hope this spectral story sent a delightful shiver down your spine, adding an extra layer of mystery to your holiday festivals. From the ethereal realms to the warmth of your heart, we thank you for joining us on this ghostly journey through the Christmas season. As you step away from the darkness and back into the twinkling lights of your holiday celebrations, may your spirits, real or imagined, linger only in your imagination. Dead Evil Tales wishes each and every one of you a Merry Christmas. May your remaining December days be filled with joy. Your nights be free from restless ghosts. But take heed. As the new year approaches, we have many more tales of horror to keep you awake in the dark hours of 2024. Thank you for being a part of our spectral gathering. Until next time, keep the candles burning and the ghost stories alive. Merry Christmas, dear listeners.